This is Pulse.
Hello, and you're listening to Pulse Radio, LSESU's official radio station. My name is Mike Pearson.
And my name is Christina Meisker.
And you're listening to The Interview Hour.
Each Friday between 5 to 6 on The Interview Hour, we'll be talking to distinguished figures from the fields of politics, current affairs, arts and academia.
We'll try and find out how they became interested in their field, discuss their career as a whole, and talk about the relevant issues of the day.
You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/TheInterviewHour or on our website at www.pulselse.com.
If you want to join the debate on Twitter, it's at Pulse Radio LSE, or if you want to email the show, it's onair@pulselse.co.uk.
Now, we're joined in the studio today by a musician and folk punk songwriter. He's an alumni of the LSE, has toured extensively around the world, and is a staple of festival audiences across the circuit.
He's picked up a growing following in recent years and played at the Olympic opening ceremony, where he played to an estimated UK television audience of 28 million. Frank Turner, welcome to Pulse Radio.
Hi there, how you doing?
We're doing all right, how are you?
Yeah, good. It's very nice and slightly odd to be back at the LSE again, but in a good way. Good odd.
And speaking of LSE, what are your memories?
Well, I was about to say I spent 3 years here, but I didn't quite, because I started touring really hard while I was here, and they did actually try and kick me out in my third year because I didn't show up at all. Not out of kind of, laziness or truancy or whatever, because I was generally sort of in Belgium playing a hardcore festival or something. And I remember getting a phone call. I was in a pub called the Vic Inn in Derby, and I got a phone call telling me I was being kicked out because I hadn't been to any like classes or anything for ages. I managed to talk them down from it. But yeah, I spent a good whack of my time here, and it's nice to be back.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I learned a lot, which is obviously the point of an educational establishment. I got my kind of passion for history kind of really crystallised. I studied international history here, and that really sort of came together while I was here. I made some good friends, and it was a good time.
Is there a part of the building or campus that brings back fond memories?
To be honest, walking through the CAF downstairs, the quad, of course. Walking through the quad was pretty amazing. I used to spend a lot of my time in there, and both kind of working and reading and that kind of thing, and then also kind of going to bad club nights. Do you know what I mean?
Do you remember?
Crush. Was it?
Yeah, Crush.
Was it
Crush? I went to Crush like twice, I think it was, but it wasn't really my scene. But I did. I played in the basement of the Three Tons a couple of times. Is that right?
Yeah.
I remember playing down there. There's no stage, and just kind of like having really fierce punk shows down there. That was a good time.
And I actually wanted to ask you: Did you have rights bar when you were at uni? Or
I did. Yes, kind of. It was weird. I was kind of. I was quite vegetarian, verging on vegan when I was here, and reasonably militant.
Doesn't quite accommodate.
which I'm not anymore at all. But people change when they get older.
Okay, and so your career generally, what made you go into music? What was how did you start off, and where did you get your first inspiration from?
I think that music was something that kind of was definitely. Has been a huge part of my life since I was about 10. My parents are kind of into classical music, but they're not really into anything involving guitars or post about 1900s, do you know what I mean? I didn't like have Beatles and Dylan in the house, that sort of thing. But actually the first band I ever fell in love with was Iron Maiden, funnily enough, who are still one of my favourite bands. You can prize them out of my cold, dead hands. But a friend of mine's older brother had a cool poster, and I was like 10 years old and I got into it. But since then, I instantly kind of like started bugging my parents to get me a guitar for Christmas or whatever, and I got one of those cheap black and white Strat copies with a 30 watt amp. Total nonsense. I've still got it somewhere. And just started playing. And then by the time I kind of, I went to school, I was in bands. I did my first tour when I was 16 because I got into punk rock and the sort of empowerment idea behind punk rock, the idea that you don't wait around for people to organise life for you. If you want to do something, just go and do it. Mm. So the first tour I did when I was 16, we had a list of venue phone numbers from the back of a zine called Fracture Zine. It was this free hardcore zine, and there were places that were put on punk shows, and we were a little punk band called Knee Jerk, terrible band, we called them, and we managed to put together a 2 week tour of the UK, and it was a disaster. There was no people, everyone flew. I remember we played a gig in Leeds and there was no people, and then we went to stay at this guy's house and there was a house party that was full of people, so we played again. And yeah, just kind of complete ramshackle chaos, and I absolutely fell in love with it.
So would you say you were like a natural performer from the age of 16 when you started touring?
I'm not sure about performer as such. I definitely wanted to play music. I wanted to play it in front of people. I'm not sure that was any good
for a long time. Yeah, and now you've done over 1,000 gigs. You must be...
Well, I mean, it's not really for me to say, but I'm certainly better than I was when I was 16, there's progress for you. But, it was definitely... I think there's something about touring in particular and a kind of an itinerant lifestyle, if you like, that's quite... I was going to say it's addictive, but it's also one of those things that you're either into or you're not. Do you know what I mean? And on that first tour, there was about 10 or 12 of us went on the tour because it was two bands hanging out. And I mean, about three people quit in the first like 2 days. And then when we got back, some people were like, never doing that again. Some people were like, yeah, it was alright. And then one or two people, including me, were like, this is the greatest way of existing. And
do you still feel that way?
Absolutely.
That it's the greatest way of existing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just like to keep moving, you know. I've got another tour starting tomorrow and it runs through till the end of the year, and then I've had a meeting the other day that booked my life up until January 2014 on the move. So yeah, I like moving.
What is it about being on the move that you like so much?
A number of things. I mean, it's very liberating. In some ways it's very liberating, being in a different place every day, you know, meeting new people. I'm a gregarious person. I like meeting new people, making new friends, and sort of, you know, getting a taste of existence all over the world. Do you know what I mean? Seeing how people live, and one of the things I'm happy about is that, unlike some bands, I did an awful lot of DIY touring. Like the first like 5 times I went to the States was just driving around playing squats and coffee shops and staying in people's houses. And in that kind of way, you know, if you do the tour bus and hotels tour, it's fun, it's nice, it's a lot more comfortable, but you generally don't sort of meet that many people who live in the place. Whereas now that I am doing the tour bus tours, I'm always meeting up with the people who I met when I was doing the scummy DIY tours kind of thing. But it's cool, you know. It's like, I mean, the American election being quite a good example, is I have friends from all over the States and a variety of opinions, and you know, I think there's a lot of angles on American politics that get completely missed in this country, for better or worse. But it's interesting on that level. I can't remember what I was talking about.
And do you have any? This probably maybe don't want to talk about it, but any awkward experiences when performing, like the worst?
Oh yeah.
Gig ever?
No, okay, right. I'm answering the question in a roundabout way, I promise. The whole kind of like precious, fragile glass ego thing that a lot of kind of public figure type people have, it makes no sense to me, simply because the act of getting up on a stage and performing in front of people night on night necessarily involves public humiliation on a daily basis. I make an idiot out of myself every day, you know, and even in small ways. I'll, you know, drop a pick, forget a line to a song I've been singing for 10 years. The other day in New York, I forgot that we had an intro tape, so I walked confidently out into the middle of the stage, leaving the rest of my band in the wings going, what are you doing? Probably my favourite one, I managed to punch myself in the crotch in front of about 10,000 people once. That was bad. You know, so the thing is, from my point of view, with that kind of stuff happening every day, it makes you very good at not being precious about laughing at yourself. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, with the crotch punch incident, a friend of mine, because they had the big video screens on the side of the stage, it was at Download Festival 2004, a friend of mine actually managed to get a photo of me kind of doubled over in pain, looking like I was going to cry on a massive video screen in front of a huge audience of people. And I feel like if you have those things in your life, then you can't really be up yourself.
And also, it adds to your kind of overall kind of personality as well at the same time, because people that can't see you as a human, as if people don't have flaws anyway.
Right, exactly. Well, and also, you know, people who can't laugh at themselves in life are terribly, terribly boring people. Like, and I, yeah, always make an idiot out of yourself and laugh about it afterwards.
Okay.
That's what I say.
good message to everybody out there. Okay, and in terms of how you developed during your career, when was the moment that you kind of learnt the most or had the biggest challenge?
I would say, I mean, so I was in a band called Men in Dead, and that existed while I was here at LSE, and existed for another couple of years after I left. And then it broke up pretty acrimoniously, which was very depressing, and because I was very passionate about the band, you know, I didn't want it to end, and it came to an end, and I decided to start playing, like, solo acoustic music, just go out with a guitar. I had a slight kind of Woody Guthrie fixation, you know, getting a train with a guitar and a rucksack and travel the country, which I did for about 18 months straight, but... It was It's one of those periods of my life that I look back and mark down as kind of glad I did it, definitely don't want to do it again. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Because it was pretty miserable at times, but I learned like so much about self-reliance and about how to tour and about songwriting and about performance and entertaining the crowd, getting a bunch of people to pay attention to you when you're in a noisy bar full of people who don't care, you know, from there on down, how to make a pillow out of a pair of shoes and a jacket, you know, like... or, you know, how to run tour finances, all those kind of things definitely came from that period of time.
And which part of it do you enjoy most? Is it recording in the studio? Is it the touring, the office?
No, I kind of hate the studio, actually. Like, because...
So did you bring you in heaven?
No, well, this is fine, but, like, I've actually just got back from a month in the recording studio in the States. And, it, you know, it was a positive experience. We've come out with what I think is going to be an amazing record, but... The thing about, again, one of the things I love about, I guess, playing music live and touring is there's a kind of sense of, like, constant self-reinvention. Every single night you get up and you play the songs again, and if you played them badly last night, it doesn't matter, because you can play them again, you can get them right tonight. And, you know, you sing the same lyrics every night, but the trick, in a way, is to kind of feel them anew every time you sing them and find new angles in them in yourself. And, so, and that's kind of what I love about touring. Now, the thing about the studio is that you know that you're making decisions. If you sing the line this way or if you sing it that way, that's how everybody's going to remember it forever, because they'll have the recorded version and they're not going to see you play live every day. And I often sit there in the vocal booth agonising over just tiny inflections, whether I'm going to say I or we, or whether it's going to be past tense or present tense, or whether it's going to go up at the end of the line. And I drag myself into the ground thinking about it.
Speaking of your new record, is it like England Keep My Bones? Is it like Levine song?
Yeah, it's I think it's a bit more kind of I was definitely listening to a lot of stuff like The Band and Creedence Clearwater Revival and that kind of like big 60s country rock kind of vibe. I don't know how much of that... I find it hard to talk about in the abstract. Do you know what I mean? I'm way too close to it. I feel that's kind of a bit more of the vibe. That, and I might add Weezer as well, who have always been one of my favourite bands, but I've got kind of academic in my obsession with them lately, sitting there like trying to pull the songs apart and figure out what makes them good. But I mean, it's not a radical departure. It's not. There's no songs about England. I've done that. It's out of my system now. I'm free of the curse of talking about England all the time.
How do you write your songs and write lyrics?
I don't really have an interesting answer to that question, I'm afraid. It's a reflexive thing now. I've been trying to write since I was like 10 or 11 years old, since I first got a guitar, and now it's just kind of something that my brain does at all times.
Okay.
I'm always just kicking words around into different shapes. And
is it the words you find easier, or is it the melody, or...?
Either or. I mean, yeah. It sort of changes around. And obviously the jackpot is when you get both at the same time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you get a good line that arrives with a melody with it, then it's like...
So what's that song that's been where it's like...
It's fine. I mean, for me, like, there's no kind of set thing. I mean, I've got some songs that... have taken a lifetime to get right. And I mean, there's this one song in particular called Old Flames that has been on the song list for every solo record that I've made, and I've never been happy with it. It's a good song, but I can't figure out what's wrong with it. There's something amiss. But then on the other hand, like, there's a song called If Ever I Stray, which I wrote pretty much in about 20 minutes because it just kind of felt good, and then I just was playing the guitar and just writing down stuff, and there it was finished on.
Do you ever look back at your older songs and just think, oh my god, did I actually write that?
Yeah, oh yeah, very much so. Again, that's one of the sort of slightly annoying things about what I do for a living, is that all of one's past kind of opinions and foibles and mistakes are always kind of preserved in aspect. Do you know what I mean? You know, and people can dig up songs that you wrote when you were 16 and go, well, you said this then. It's like, I know that was 14 years ago. Or, you know, or indeed sort of interviews that you do when you're 19, you're drunk or whatever. And so, yes, very much so. There are songs that... it's funny, actually, sometimes you'll be on stage and somebody will request one of them, and what I would say, if I was being completely honest, is, like, why would I play that song? It's rubbish. But, obviously, you kind of... feel more polite about it than that.
There's one song I've got to ask you about, Photosynthesis.
Yes.
It's all about rejecting, you know, that sort of conformity to going, you know, working and to growing old, etc. There's a part of me when I listen to that, maybe it's just because I'm at LSE and I knew you went to LSE, that thinks, was that an influence on that song?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how kind of directly, specifically it was, but I'm not trying to be polite about the LSE. Live on air.
That's why I got slag it off, it's fine.
Well, no, I don't know, it's funny. I mean, I don't know how it is now, but certainly when I was here, there was definitely kind of a divide between people who are here for more kind of academic reasons and people who are doing the kind of more kind of business economic side of things. And with the kind of benefit of a tiny bit more age and wisdom, it's just like whatever. I mean, whatever you choose your path in life, it's not my problem if that's what you want to do. But at the time, I remember being quite frustrated because I was quite sort of idealistic about the idea that university should be a purely academic pursuit kind of thing. And it was like, you're just here to get a tag on a piece of paper to get a better job, which used to make me angry. I used to rage about that. But didn't do anything about it afterwards. Just raged in affection.
How connected are you personally to your lyrics? How much of you is reflected in them?
Most of me. It's probably the best answer to that. I mean, I don't generally do fiction because I'm not very good at it. But I do. I mean, it's not like every single detail of my personal life is related in words that I sing. But,
Twitter style.
Right, yeah. What was it? Live Journal. That was the one people used to write. It's not that. But it's certainly to me, honesty is like the thing I crave most in art. That's why I try to be honest.
Okay.
I was going to play a song. Do you have any...
Excellent.
Preference in terms of going tunes or maybe a song from
when you're 16, you know?
Influence or
I think, well, you know, let me think about this for a tiny moment here. A band that I've been deeply obsessed with lately is a band called The National. I don't know if you're familiar with The National. They're a band from the States who I think have played quite a big role on the new record that I've just done because they're truly, truly fantastic band. Presumably I have to pick a song that's clean lyrically.
That would be an advantage.
That's fine. There's an album called Alligator, and the first track on it is possibly called Secret Meeting. I'm terrible with songs.
Yes, I think we have it.
Truly, truly fantastic piece of art. I would have picked Mr. November, but it's really not at all clean. So if you're listening and you want to listen to a great song, listen to Mr. November. But this one's also great.
Unfortunately, Pulse doesn't.
I know. I once did an American radio show where they told me that every cuss word that I said on air would generate $250,000 fine.
Really?
I mean, for the radio station, but they sort of implied that I would be liable for it in some way, so you get quite good at not swearing.
Make you thankful that we've got Ofcom then.
Exactly.
Okay, here's The National and Secret Meeting on Pulse Radio.
Pulse Radio.
Just before we finished, started playing that song, you mentioned Ofcom and radio, and you mentioned German radio before.
Oh, yeah.
So can you just take us through your, media experiences, including Germany?
I've been through a few, yeah. I mean, the thing is, I should preface this by saying that I have a lot of love for touring in Eastern Europe. It's, you know, the kind of former Soviet bloc countries. And in part, the reason it's great touring there is because they have so much less. You know, in terms of infrastructure and everything, not least radio. The fact that there are people out there kind of putting on shows, having punk rock shows, radio shows, whatever, is great and slightly more impressive than doing it in London.
Slightly more raw.
Yeah, you know, I've been on some East German kind of radio shows where it's like, there's a guy with like one of those microphones you get from Argos for like £5 or whatever and a tape machine. Hello. It's like, oh, okay. The first Eastern European touring I did actually was in the Baltics, in Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia, and just some of my very best friends out there, touring friends. And it's great. It's a fantastic part of the world. But it's not the best radio shows.
We've got some questions that people have asked via Facebook.
Excellent.
This one's from Mimi Hartigan in Plymouth.
Okay.
I think that's how you say her name. She says, which one of your songs is your favourite to play acoustically?
That's an interesting question. Playing stuff acoustically is kind of fun because I like kind of reconstituting songs. Adam Jurich from the Counting Crows is the master of this. Like, he says a song is a skeleton and you can put different clothes and flesh on it. And it's really fun to take like a song that on record is kind of noisy and upbeat. Like, there's a song in English on Bones called One Foot Before the Other, and on the record it's really like thrashy, and I figured out a way of doing it solo which I really like because it's weird and it suddenly becomes this slightly different, more twisted, evil kind of beast.
Yeah.
I something along those lines. And then, of course, there's something about the kind of naked fragility of one human with one instrument on it, you know, that is the classic Bob Dylan or whatever, just a finger pick a guitar and say.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few songs on a few of your records, like the Falcon's first 3 years or second 3 years, where you've got Dancing Queen, you've got Greatest Day, Bill
McBurk. I like, you've got to have bands who they sound like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, there's not a massive point in me going out and doing, like, a full band Springsteen cover or a Billy Bragg cover or something, because it's just, that's the ballpark I operate in anyway. Just have more fun with it, you know? Yeah. And I'm also unashamed of my love for ABBA, damn it. I won't be backed into the corner on this one.
And Mimi from Plymouth says, can you stop going to America and go to Plymouth more, please?
Oh, but I've been to Plymouth more than I've been to America in the grand scheme of things. I think last time I was there was White Rabbit last year, and a good time it was as well. And I will be back, I promise. Anyway, I'm playing in Truro soon, so come to that show.
There you are, Mimi. Simon Hewitt says, as a musician, do you think you can get your message across to an audience better than if you decided to go into politics?
It depends entirely on what your message is. If your message is supposed to have any kind of sort of intellectual depth or coherence, then absolutely no. Music's entirely... Yeah, I don't really subscribe to the idea of music being a particularly profound political tool. You know, if you see, that's an interesting thing, but he didn't cause them, he didn't make any of the social changes that happen. Do you know what I mean?
They contributed to the culture of the time. That generated,
I regard him as a commentator rather than an actor. Do you know what I mean? And that's great. I mean, I love music. So, but if your interest in life is to change the world and make it a better place, then be a politician, don't be a musician. I'm a professional entertainer. I'm very proud to be one, but I'm not. That's the other thing. I don't actually have any particular political message that I'm trying to impart. I'm just trying to write good rock and roll songs.
Okay.
Boom.
And which one of your songs is your favourite one personally, if you had to listen to it? Can you listen to your own voice, or
annoying? After many, many years in recording studios, that's not so much an issue for me now. I mean, it was at one point, but I don't know, it's hard. The boring answer to that question is some of the new stuff that I've just finished working on. There's a song that's going to be on the new record called Broken Piano that is a... I was going to say departure. I mean, it's more unusual for me stylistically, and I'm really, really happy with it, because I've got this massive kind of niche in my music taste for kind of a lot of kind of like atmospheric post-rock stuff like Godspeed and Sigur Rós and that kind of thing, and it's got a little bit of that vibe to it, which is a new thing for me. So.
Okay.
So how did you come about liking sort of quite sort of hardcore stuff and quite sort of stuff like Bob Dylan? Like,
I mean, the kind of punk side of things definitely came first, you know. I mean, I know there's recent years seen a lot of people kind of start doing acoustic records, which is fine, but a lot of people's like, oh, I'm going back to my roots. I'm definitely not going back to my roots. My roots are Black Flag, Minor Threat, Dead Kennedys, NOFX and Descendants, you know.
Yeah.
I started listening to Springsteen's Nebraska and the Johnny Cash American Recording Series and Josh Rao's first couple of albums, stuff like that, at Townes Van Zandt, whose initials I have on my wrist as a tattoo. I think it was because I was touring in a noisy hardcore band with other noisy hardcore bands playing those hardcore, and someone would always put something noisy and hardcore in the van, and sort of as an escape, you put your headphones on and then listen to Townes Van Zandt live at the Old Quarter, and then sanity returns, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And your fans, do they give you quite a lot of feedback, or do you like them? Were they obsessive at times? Or
I went into playing acoustic music for having been in a hardcore band with the expectation that zero people would follow, if you see what I mean. I didn't think that anybody would get it or would like it, and a lot of people didn't, which is completely fair enough, you know. I still get people going, oh, I prefer Million Dead, to which I go, fine, that's a legitimate opinion and good for you, but it doesn't mean I'm going to do it again. That period of my life is done, thank you very much. But, you know, it's a perfectly legitimate thing to say. But, you know, what I want to do right now is play this kind of music. And actually, quite a few people did follow over from the Million Dead thing, which was a pleasant surprise.
Of course, you've now got a new project.
Yeah, Mongol Hood.
I wasn't sure how to pronounce it, because you've got little accents
Mongol Hood. The other guys in the band dispute that pronunciation. Okay. I should point out, for the sake of accuracy.
So how do you see that developing? Because you obviously played Leeds and Reading.
Yeah, we did four shows this summer. It was a ton of fun. And it really felt like scratching an itch first time. Although it also revealed to me that I am no longer 21. And my God, I was tired after 20 minutes there.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I mean, it's something I want to do more of. I want to do an album, and I want to do a proper UK tour at some point. But it won't be anytime enormously soon, because it's a kind of second priority, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's, now that we've just finished doing a new album in the States for my own stuff, that's kind of the next kind of 2 years of my life kind of locked out of the diary.
Yeah.
You mentioned not being 21 anymore. How do you find being an artist, like, is when you're a bit older and have a bit more wisdom perhaps? Do you feel the same adrenaline that you felt at the start of your career? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's in a slightly more kind of measured way now, but I definitely... I think one of the things I'm kind of happy about is that to the extent that I am a successful artist, which is something I'm always slightly nervous about saying because I kind of constantly expect the roof to fall in at all times. But I'm kind of glad that the success I've had has come to me kind of in my late 20s, and I'm 30 now, you know. I see a lot of bands kind of getting very, very successful like straight away before they've done a lot of touring and when they're still quite young. And in a way I feel kind of sorry for them, because the tools that you need in order to kind of survive that kind of thing, because it's a weird thing to happen, you know, to suddenly find yourself playing Brixton Academy, you know, when you've only done like one tour before. I know people in those shoes, and it's a difficult thing to cope with for anybody. And if you've got more experience, if you've already done 1,000 shows to know people in the basement of the three towns or whatever, then it gives you a kind of grounding with which to kind of like, it's almost like a sense of detachment from the whole thing that enables you to kind of be more protected. And so yeah, I'm happy to be
protected from what?
Well, protected from essentially from burning out, from becoming an idiot, or what, you know, I'm sort of choosing my words carefully. It's all from rock and roll cliche, from becoming Mickey Rourke, you know, or whatever, burning out and just kind of letting it all overwhelm you, because it is weird. If the whole world's suddenly trying to kiss your ass, then you need to be able to kind of step back from that and realise that it's transient.
Don't you think part of that has touched you though? Do you feel that you've changed as a person a little bit?
I've definitely changed as a person. I mean, it's funny, I occasionally kind of run into friends from when I was younger who say, "You've changed," to me, as if it's like in an accusatory tone of voice, to which I can only say, "Well, yes, I mean, I was trying to. Surely this is the point of existence on this planet, is to absorb new experience and grow as a person. I don't want to spend my entire life being the person I was when I was 16. I was an idiot when I was 16, you know. I've changed. But I mean, I think I've definitely, you know, I've had some bizarre experiences with, you know, it's a strange thing if somebody's got kind of words that you've written tattooed on their skin, or starts crying when you meet them, or, you know, that sort of thing. And but I mean, it's all happened to me once I've also had years and years and years of playing music, and people's reaction being to kind of yawn or tell me to shut up or whatever, you know, and it gives you a balance.
Do you often find yourself looking back and reminiscing on those times when you did have different experiences, you were a different person, and writing about that, or do you write very much in the moment?
I try and write in the moment. Well, I have written songs about looking back, but I kind of feel like everybody is allowed a few of those.
Yeah,
I mean, two or three, maybe. And then, you know, just shut up and write about something more relevant. But yeah, I mean, it's funny. Everybody in a band, certainly anybody in a successful band, will probably spend their entire lives reminiscing in like eye-gougingly boring ways about the old days, man, swimming back in the van.
Yeah.
And you know, and yet, if you took them and put them back in the van right there and then, they wouldn't enjoy
it. They'd complain about it.
Right, exactly. You know, I'm glad that I did the kind of all those kind of really grueling years of sleeping on the floor and that kind of thing. But I don't sleep on the floor very often anymore, and that's fine.
And how do you see the future?
I don't know. You know, as I said earlier, I kind of operate on the assumption that all of this is some kind of giant cosmic mistake, and that at any moment the reality police are going to knock on my door and go, "Really sorry, there's been a mistake." I mean, also, there's a degree of kind of psychological self-defense in that, in the sense that, like, what I do for a living is quite sort of self-invested, sort of ego-wise or whatever. At the end of the day, if I put out a record and it sells less than the one before, or people stop coming to my gigs, it's a natural psychological thing to go, "No one likes me." which obviously isn't true at all, and you ride the vicissitudes of fate, but... so as a degree of self-protection, yeah, sure, I kind of operate on the principle that this is transitory. Having said all that, if I was able to be a Neil Young or a Bruce Springsteen or someone like that, obviously, yes, I'm in, sign me up, that's fine. But I guess we'll see. I mean, it's way too easy and cheesy to say, "Take each day as it comes, man." But it'll probably take each year as it comes.
If it is transitory and you suddenly lost everything, what perks would you miss the most of being so well?
I get to do what I love for a living. The dirty secret that everybody's a professional musician is that we do it for free. You don't have to pay us. Do you know what I mean? Mm. This is our passion. This is what we love doing. And to be able to make a living out of traveling and doing the thing that you love is just the most enormous privilege.
It's also a privilege to find something you're passionate about for many people.
Right. Sure, absolutely.
Were you sure that was your passion from a young age?
From a very young age. And I distinctly remember actually when I was leaving LSE, there's a traditional thing where everyone was starting to get all like, oh, what am I going to do after uni? And I didn't have that because I just knew. I was already in it. I was already on tour. I was already doing it. Do you know what I mean? And I realised at the time, and I still think now, that I was very fortunate to have that in my life, and I'm grateful for it.
Before LSE, did you ever come across in your own head a thought that said, why should I even bother going to uni if that's what I want to do?
Yeah, I did. That is a whole, as I'm sure you'll know what I'm talking about, kind of family minefield that we're talking about here. Mum and Dad didn't want me to be a musician, let's put it that way. So,
okay.
I mean, that's not the only reason I went to university. I'm very passionate about the study of history, and I'm glad I came here. But there was a degree to which it was kind of like, I'm going to get a degree under my belt, and then I can go and waste my life in a school bus playing bunker squats in Belgium or whatever.
So when you were here, did you find like LSE inhibited or prevented your artistic expression at all?
No, only in the sense that sometimes we had to book tour schedules around the fact that I had exams. But that's not really a serious inhibition.
The culture of LSE didn't really affect you at all.
I enjoyed the culture of LSE. I spent an enormous amount of time reading Alpha books and I used to go and buy kind of Bakunin books from there and read them, and so it was, intellectually it was a very enriching place.
Has your family been convinced by now, I guess, about your...
My mum's on side. I'll say that and kind of no more. When I did the Olympics thing this summer, an awful lot of members of my family who I think had kind of slightly written me off kind of suddenly now want guest lists for shows. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so that's like, yay, that's my family member.
Yeah.
Great.
That's my cousin, that is. It's like, I know. You weren't interested in me last week. Anyway,
how did you find the whole Olympic experience?
It was weird, is the honest answer to that. I mean, I'm very glad I did it. It's a cool thing to be part of, to be associated with, and to have worked with Danny Boyle is amazing, because he is amazing. Plus also, at the end of the day, my general approach to life is to say yes to new experiences. You know what I mean?
And the new experience of playing on the mound in a stadium.
Right. And yeah. It's just kind of like, do I really want to grow up to be that guy who didn't play the Olympics but could have done? I mean, that's a boring story to tell in the pub as an old man. Do you know what I mean? It was very odd. And the kind of like, we all got, like me and my band and crew all got, had to get like terrorist background checks and stuff. And it was like, really? All our gear was kind of like, torn apart by their technicians to see if it had any bombs in it or whatever, it's an acoustic guitar, come on. There was very much a kind of like a sort of bureaucratic machine there, which was kind of intimidating, and I didn't enjoy being around very much.
Was the crowd completely different from what you were usually used to?
As an actual gig, it was very strange because no one was there to see me play, do you know what I mean? Or indeed see any band of any kind play. The crowd, they were very nice. People were very receptive. They had sort of about 80,000 people in the stadium when we played. Yeah, they clapped at the end. That was good.
And I guess because it was so far away.
They're miles away. But also, I'd imagine that 99.9% of them were going, who's this guy? What's going on right now? It was fun to do.
At least you didn't have any awkward moments like the previous
one. No, I didn't. Well, actually, there was nearly one. I had the weirdest, the most stressful conversation of my life. Basically, how to explain this? We had two dress rehearsals, and the first one went fine, no technical hitches, all good. The second one, basically, my monitor guy, Johnny, who's the guy who controls what I hear when I'm on stage, right? He was there, but because of the nature of the thing, he was hidden underneath the hill. He was underneath my feet, but he has like a microphone. He can talk to me, it's into my earpieces, and I can talk into my mic to him. So I walk out, set up, get my guitar going, and then Johnny goes, "All right, Frank, you're doing this. And I said, yes, into the microphone, but no sound came out. And he was like, and then they was like, oh, he's not there yet. And there's no visual communication. Basically, they thought I was just wandering around the hill somewhere. I stand there going, the microphone isn't plugged in. And I had no way of signalling this information to anybody. And it got very, very, very close to the moment where I actually had to start singing. For one of the techs came sprinting out of the back and sort of dived. And then rolled down the hill and I started singing and it was alright, but my heart rate, which was kind of high anyway, had just gone through the roof. I was like panicking,
but this didn't happen in the actual ceremony.
Yes, right, exactly. Well, the thing is, after that went down, that was on the Wednesday, the ceremony was on the Friday, so they spent 2 days like absolutely like making damn sure that wasn't going to happen again.
And do you take care of your voice? I guess it's different from, like, for example, opera singers, like, walk around with scarves and stuff. You don't have the same kind of protection of your...
No, I think there's a degree of melodrama in wearing a scarf.
Stuff is like expression, you know? Huh? Or just like fashion sense.
Well, exactly. I mean, I spend an awful, like a tediously large amount of time thinking about my throat, because it is my main kind of... I mean, instrument, source of income, whatever you want to call it, you know. But when I'm on the road, I spend a lot of time kind of warming up, warming down, drinking the right drinks and stuff. But I can't really think that wearing a scarf or not makes that much of a difference.
Just an example.
No, yeah. I know.
Give it a go when you're next on the road.
I think it could add a lot. Yeah,
you know what? I will try. I'll let you know how it goes.
Of course, I mentioned you're on the road. Of course,
yes,
starting tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I plug it, except that it's all sold out unless you live in Margate, in which case there are still tickets.
I'm not sure whether that would be in Margate, but...
it's funny. The thing with the Margate show, incidentally, is that... So, every time bands do a UK tour, like the booking agents and the promoters and everybody, one of the little calculations they always do is that people who live in Kent will go to the London show. So you don't do a Kent show, you just do London.
Yeah.
And things, having spent some time gigging around Kent, it's a big county, it's a cool county, and some places in Kent takes like 2.5 hours to get to London, do you know what I mean? Mm. I thought to myself, no, do you know what I mean? I'm going to take the rock and roll to Kent. I'm not going to be one of these idiots who just plays in London. I'm going to go and I'm going to play in Margate. So we booked a show in Margate, and it turns out not that many people are interested. I mean, that's bad. We've sold a ton of tickets for the show, but it is the only one that's not sold out.
But it's easier to do that in the US, I guess, when you've got sort of, it's very dispersedly.
Yeah, people travel in the States for gigs. You know, I mean, I constantly meet people in American shows who are like, oh yeah, I drove 7 hours to be here. And it's like, really? Yeah. If you drove 7 hours in any direction from any point in England, you would be in the sea. Maybe Scotland.
Okay. Well, I think we're going on to some more music.
Excellent.
You mentioned before, do you have a preference what we play, or should we select for you?
I think that you guys should choose for me, because I have no objectivity about the music that I make, so I'm very happy for you guys to choose.
Okay. Well,
okay.
Mike, you go first.
I'll choose a song myself, which I love because of the sort of romanticism of the song. It's To Take You Home.
Lovely choice.
This is Pulse.
Show from the land of Amazons, but you're still my mademoiselle. And it goes to show you never can tell. She was a quiet one, she was a shy one, she was the prettiest at the show. She cooked so slyly, she cooked up behind me, but still she pretended that she didn't.
Welcome back to Pulse Radio, live in the studio. We've got Frank Turner, former LSE alumni, of course.
Yes.
LSE, did you live in a hall when you were here?
Yeah.
Which hall did you live in?
The one, what is it called? It's next to the gym on the top of Shaftesbury Avenue. It's kind of...
Holborn?
Yeah, High Holborn.
Holborn, yeah.
I lived there for a year. And basically just went, oh my god, I'm like 2 minutes walk away from the Crowbar and all the other cool bars in Soho, so then just got smashed all the time. Terrible. Yeah.
Conducive to student life then.
Well, yes, exactly. I was there for a year in probably like 2001, I guess that would have been, back when I was young and good looking. So, or something.
And you went to Eton as well?
I did. I was a scholarship kid.
And how did you find that, the culture at Eton, atmosphere?
I always want to be quite careful what I say about this because, for a start, it's an incredible head start in life, you know, to get an education of that quality. It was an amazing education, and I have a fair few good friends from that time in my life, but I felt quite socially awkward and alienated when I was there and did not generally get on with the kind of general milieu, you know what I mean? I think that's one of the reasons why I fell in love with punk rock specifically, is because it was kind of, I felt very removed from most of the people around me, and there's something about the kind of rage and defiance and outsiderness of punk that really kind of spoke to me.
So I'm guessing you weren't that involved in the musical aspect of Eton?
No, I mean, I was in a band while I was there, but everybody hated us. Really.
That improved your resilience to the gigs,
we were kind of trying to make them hate us, so it was a two-way street, definitely. But
how do you find that relationship with people that you are at school with now, but who hated you? Did they ever...
Occasionally. It wasn't everybody. I had good friends from that time, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on... I'm really sick of this socially acceptable kind of prejudice of just anybody who went there is like, oh, you can call them anything you like, and it's kind of fine, because that I get annoyed with people who insult me and spit on me and call me all names under the sun because of where my parents chose to send me to school, you know. But you can't generalise or stereotype or whatever, but we were definitely working quite hard to make people hate us and yeah, there are stories to be told. I'll let other people tell.
Okay, well, maybe not for Odoo. What is your best friend has like from bands that you've had, or have you ever just completely clashed with people that you've worked with?
There are one or two bands who I've toured with who I haven't got on with. I'm not going to mention any names because that seems unnecessary to me. One thing I will say is that something that's quite nice about the world of touring music is it's reasonably filtered out. Like, if you're if you're unkind and unpleasant to people you work with, to the bands you tour with and all that kind of thing, you're just not going to last very long. And at the end of the day, most bands who have any kind of longevity learn the lesson pretty damn fast that you just got to be considerate to your crew, to other people's crew, you know, to other bands you tour with, and life gets an awful lot easier, you know. I mean, of course, you know, Guns N' Roses do exist, and... Oh, I can't say what I want to say about them without breaking the no swearing rule. But, you know, but for the most part, I mean, like, to pick one example of many, I've done a fair amount of touring with the Dropkick Murphys, and I'm out again with them in January, and they're just some of the nicest, friendliest, most considerate, kind, welcoming people ever. Mm. And like, really, really awesome, awesome guys.
I mean, how do you prefer, as a solo artist or in a band, especially on the
I, at this moment in my time, I'm having my cake and eating it because I've got a backing band, but they are definitely it's a weird thing because it's like they're not just kind of random hired guns. It's been the same guys for 4 or maybe 5 years now, but at the same time it's my project, it's my name on the banner and all that kind of thing, so I get the sort of dictatorship of being a solo artist.
Do you find that easier than sort of if you try to win a band's democracy than that?
Yeah, I mean, Me and Deb was a rigorous like ideologically pure democracy, do you know what I mean? Which, and there are days when I think that was a good thing and that it made us a better band than we would otherwise have been, but it was also extremely stressful at times, and we nearly broke up discussing the artwork to our first album, and it's just idiotic looking back on it now, but there was a lot of screaming and shouting and all that kind of thing. I don't have to do so much of that anymore.
What do you think makes you make someone resilient within the music industry? Is there a way of finding opportunities or...
Yeah, I mean, there is a small part of it, at least, which is just kind of innate, I think. Like, certainly if you're talking about, like, touring and travelling in the live music industry, some people like creature comforts, do you know what I mean? Mm. If you're one of them, then you're probably not going to last on tour for very long because one's standards of comfort and personal hygiene and laundry go descend when, when you're on the road. But at the same time, I mean, one of my main kind of philosophical bugbears in life is about self-invention. I think that people can become the things they want to be if you work hard enough at them, for the most part. Obviously not limitlessly, but, you know, I wasn't... When I started doing what I do, I wasn't kind of like a seasoned road dog from age 10, you know, and I couldn't particularly sing or play guitar particularly well, but I put my mind to it and worked on it, and there it is.
How do you find the music industry nowadays as opposed to when you started?
It's a world in flux is probably the safest thing to say about it. It's changing a lot. You know, downloading has been a massive sort of whirlwind, essentially, through the structure of the music industry.
Do you think that's helped you as like a conduit to...
Yes and no. I mean... you know, a lot of good, hard-working and low-paid, honest people lost their jobs because kids can't be asked to pay for music they like, which is something... There are ways of looking at that which make me very angry, you know, especially when people bring in all the sort of Pirate Bay nonsense about trying to ideologize theft, essentially, at the end of the day. Having said all that, downloading exists. It's not going away. You can't uninvent, you know, the wheel, the combustion engine, or indeed the internet. So the music industry needs to get its ass in gear and find ways around it, which it's now finally slowly doing, and it's depressing that it took this long. So I think there are many reasons to be optimistic about it, actually, and almost kind of more now than there were maybe 5 years ago. I think that the music industry as a business model is finally starting to kind of figure itself out. I'm not a fan of Spotify, though, I have to say, because it's essentially a scam, because musicians don't get paid. Spotify makes money, labels make money, people pay money towards it, and musicians never see any of it, so...
Okay.
Do you find frustrated at labels generally?
No, it's funny, like, it's that kind of standard thing that, like, there's that cliched thing of, like, the label, like, the enemy, they're the suits and all this kind of thing, and it's just not my experience. The record labels that I've been on in my life have always been just, I mean, the best word is probably colleagues. They're people I work with every day. I mean, I spend all day every day sending emails to and from label people, working out everything from artwork to every tiny detail, everything, and they generally end up becoming my friends as well, and I don't feel antagonistic towards them.
So why do you think people generally have that?
Partly because in the past labels were a lot worse, but also I think there's a tendency, some people in some bands have a tendency to take out their frustrations at not fully understanding a situation by shouting at the label. Something I find very depressing that you see every now and again, and that I try and agitate against, is people in bands who kind of sign up to aspects of the music industry without understanding it. If you're going to be a professional musician, understand your industry. Do you know what I mean? Understand what cross-recoupable means. Understand what the difference between the publishing and the record contract is. Understand what you're signing, who's doing what, who's getting paid what, and why, and when. And you know, I don't understand all the music industry at all. There's vast areas of it that I find extremely confusing, but I'm trying. Do you know what I mean? And yeah. You kind of encounter for some people in bands who are just kind of like, oh yeah, I don't really care. And it's like, well, then you're going to get screwed over at the end of the day. It's just going to happen.
And we were thinking about folk generally, and I think we were discussing previously how we think it's increasing in popularity. How do you find the reception is to your genre of music lately in comparison to when you started off?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's certainly a lot more people at my shows now than there was in 2007.
Is that because of you or the genre? I don't know. I'm not really sure
what genre I fit into. I'm reasonably fiercely proud of the fact that I didn't come up with any particular scene. Do you know what I mean? I think I'm an ex-scene artist, and those were always my favourites when I was a kid. Like, one of my favourite bands is Jesus Lizard, and one of the things I loved about them is they just had nothing to do with any other bands around them at the time, or arguably before them or since, and they just stand alone. And there's just something that becomes a tiny bit bandwagony about, like, you know, the Seattle sound. It's like, well, that's irrelevant where they're from, yeah. You know. I don't know. It's not really for me to say why there's people. Lots of people come to my shows. I'm very glad they do. That's great. Thank you. But I think other people can analyse that.
Did you not think that there's certain sounds from different areas then, or like a London vibe? Or
there is. But I think that it's speaking from the point of view of an artist, it's a bad reason to start making a particular type of music,
yeah,
because you happen to live in somebody who's doing it as well. Do you know what I mean? Or whatever. That just doesn't really kind of compute to me particularly.
Was London quite a good place to study and experiment musically?
Yes. I mean, there's a lot of cool underground stuff in London. You know, there's a lot of cool bars. The Wheelbarrow in Camden gets a shout out from me. I mean, partly because I half live there, but also because they have new bands on every night. It's always pretty good, and there's an amazing bunch of stuff going on there. There is that kind of cliche of, like, band from small town goes, we're going to go to London to make a fortune. Don't do that. Don't do that, because it's just not going to work like that. You can come to London and immerse yourself in the music scene, but this idea that you have, if you're in a band, that you'll suddenly do amazingly well if you move to London is bogus.
Okay.
And I've seen good bands smash themselves up on the rocks trying to do that. And at the end of the day, if you're good at what you do, make a noise where you are, and the music industry will come to you.
Yeah, and I guess you take that identity with you as well from where you, if it's home, then you'll start connecting that with you rather than trying to pretend to be something else.
Like the Futureheads, very much. Like they're a Geordie band, do you know what I mean? And actually, I think they're technically Macams. They might kill me now. But they're definitely, you know, they're a northeast band. They're from that scene, and they're proud of it. And it's great. It makes me like them more as a band rather than if they just all upsticks to London and attempted to start sounding like the Libertines.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we'll end on one more song.
Yeah, that's
You got any preference on this?
I think we should play something I'm thinking to Keep My Bones is my preference on this. But beyond that, I think that the choice is yours.
No, we'll go with your preference.
It's a choice and a half, though. That's that thing. Should we end with Wessex Boy?
That sounds like a good one to me.
Here's... Oh.
1 second. And to any bands, potential bands, if you had to find something to fill the gap in the music industry right now, what would you like to see?
As in new bands coming
out?
There is a ton. I don't know. Periodically, somebody somewhere says, oh, the state of music is terrible. And the only answer to that is you're not paying enough attention, because there's so much good music out there coming out. I mean, again, staying at the Wheelbarrow, like, you just kind of wander downstairs of an afternoon and there's some incredible band playing. I encountered a band called Ghouls there the other day, who were amazing. So I'm now trying to get them on a bunch of festivals this summer and that kind of thing. One of the things about the internet that's great is that music is less monolithic. You don't have to have... Like, when I was a kid, it was like the Britpop thing, you know, you had like Blur versus Oasis, and you had to pick a side. And it was just, now that wouldn't ever happen anymore, and it's a good thing, because at the time I kind of had to run away and try really hard to find other music to listen to. I discovered Black Flag, it was fine. But these days, if that happened, any kid could just turn around and go, sort of, don't care, I'm gonna go and you know, just go on the internet and listen to anything. Yeah. I mean, find Black Flag in 5 seconds.
But I guess back then it was so sort of commercialized, and it was all about the media driving that whole industry, I guess.
To find a Black Flag record in 1995 was a challenge.
Yeah.
I really had to look pretty hard to find one, whereas now, if I say Black Flag to you, you can find everything they've ever recorded in about one YouTube search or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And I actually that is a positive side of things, because it means that people don't you don't get like trapped in these little enclaves anymore. So in terms of like styles coming out, it's like, again, it's every now and again someone goes, oh, guitar music's dying. It's like, no, it isn't. Shut up. You know, maybe you don't like it anymore, but who cares? Go and listen to something else then, and we'll just carry on doing what we were doing anyway. You hipster idiot. But you know, so rant. You know, so if there's some exciting hot new synth band, that's great, good for them. I hope they do well and succeed in their life, but I can happily ignore them and keep finding out music that I like, you know, and I can go and listen to the new Two Gallants record or whatever.
Good point to end on. Okay, to all the hipsters out there. Okay, so that's Wessex Boy.
That's music.
Thank you very
like
much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for coming on. Come back to Odyssey sometime.
Oh, yeah.
That's a
idea. I should play the basement then.
Yeah, you should. Yeah. That would definitely bring up the Crush numbers.
We'll see.
Okay.
This is Wessex Boy, and this has been The Interview Hour. Thanks for listening.
Rolling? Okay. One, two, one, two, three.